I read about a study the other day that was kind of surprising to me. And I guess it was surprising in light of the a lot of negative press that traditional marriage gets. And I think just lack of press that long marriages get. It seems like in our society there's this infatuation with youth, and people just don't talk about people that have been married a long time. And maybe that's because there are fewer and fewer that have been married a long time. But Deakin University's Australian Centre on Quality of Life found that couples married 40 years or more are happier than couples in their first year of marriage. Now, if you've been married for 40 years or more, you're not really surprised by that. But maybe some of you are. And this study was connected with 2,000 Australians. And Australians are very much like us, just in case you're wondering. They live on the other side of the world, but well, sometimes we think Australia's like, where is that, another planet or something? So they measured satisfaction in seven areas of life, and this is the conclusion they came to. And it just as I read that, it was very, I don't know, it was confirming and encouraging to me, because it's always seemed to me that people that I've talked to that have been married at least 10 years, contrary to the honeymoon phase myth, marriage really does get better with time. And this is if you're in the first year of marriage or second or third, this is not to discourage you, because just think, if it's this good now and it only gets better, then it can only be better. So it's really just good news. But more and more, the people that I've talked to that have been married for some time, that's what they say. You know what? The first years, we had some rough spots here and there, or maybe had some really rough spots, but it's only gotten better, and it really is true. But to those of you that haven't been married very long, what I want to tell you, and what I believe Paul is telling us in the book of Ephesians, is it doesn't just happen. It doesn't happen accidentally. It doesn't happen automatically. Anybody whose marriage has stood the test of time for some lengthy period of time is going to tell you it's not magic. It's not pixie dust. It is blood, sweat, and tears. That forges a marriage that lasts a long time. And so I want to look at that today. We've kind of done a lot of preparation work, and what is marriage? What is it a picture of? What does it point us to? This passage in Ephesians 5 is, I think, the heart of the Bible's instruction on how do you stay married? What does it look like? The nitty-gritty hard work. So that's what we're going to talk about. So there's an outline if you want to follow along. The first thing I want to look at is covenant marriage's character. The character of covenant marriage is mutual submission. And this is in verse 21. Paul says, "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." There's one modern version that translates it, "Be subject to one another in the fear of Christ." And I realize that talking about subjection and submission in 2013 is completely swimming against the tide in our culture. And I think we have to assume in any venue, including a service of the church like this, that we just have to assume these ideas are unpopular, even though they might not be with everybody. I looked up the definition and synonyms for the word subjection, and I got a little chuckle. The Encarta Dictionary definition for subjection is the bringing of a person or people under the control of another, usually by force. And these are the synonyms for subjection: helplessness, hopelessness, weakness, inability, incapacity, domination. So that's marriage, by a lot of people's definitions. And then I looked up submission. Now, submission's a little better, a little, kinder, gentler. But the definition was a willingness to yield or surrender to somebody. But here's the example. He demanded nothing less than total submission to his authority. So I'm like, okay, you just ruined that definition. So we have to face the fact that our society assumes that submission is a dirty word. There's no other way to look at it. But we realize right away that Ephesians 5:21 does not fit into that template, because how can a married couple possibly demand mutual submission? It doesn't work. You can't do it. So this is what tells us that the Encarta folks and the rest of society doesn't really understand what the Bible means by this word. And so that's what I want to look at it more closely. Verse 21 it's different in different translations, but in your translation, it may actually be set off from both the passage that follows and the passage that precedes. And that's because that verse 21 is a link. It connects the previous passage, which speaks of not being drunk with wine, but being filled with the Holy Spirit, the Spirit's work, which is expressed in worship, singing, thanksgiving, submitting to one another. It connects that idea with husbands and wives. And so this is it's a bridge. So we're to do this. We're told, submit to one another, literally in the fear of Christ. So submit to one another as you would to Christ. So what does it mean to submit? Well, John Stott points out that the heart of the Greek word is the word taxis, not taxes, taxis, which means order. To submit is to come under authority, to recognize a certain order. So when we submit to one another out of reverence for Christ, we're recognizing that Jesus Christ has the authority over our lives, and we defer to one another and prefer one another, knowing that Jesus is our Lord. And though he was and is our Lord, he made himself a servant for us. He could have lorded over, but he did not. He did not hold on to what he could have grasped. He made himself a servant. That is the overarching character. That's the spirit of covenant marriage, mutual submission. And that character determines how we look at the specific order given to husbands and wives. This is so, so important. We have to look at we actually have to look at the submission of the wife in light of mutual submission, or else you're not going to understand it. All right, now let's look at the next one. This is the beauty of covenant marriage, is God-given authority. And this is where the really offensive part comes in. Wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Brian Chappell, in his commentary, was talking about Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson's wedding in 1986. And in the wedding ceremony, they had, I think, the three words, love, honor, and obey. Do you promise to love, honor, and obey? And so she's saying these words. And as she's saying them, she gets this little smirk on her face. And she looks over at Andrew as if to say, I'm saying these words, but you and I both know that I don't mean them. So don't get any ideas. And it's kind of sad that their marriage actually did not stand the test of time, in spite of the pedigree, in spite of all the history behind their families. But the ironic thing about the wedding vow that she repeated was, it has the word obey. And that obey does not even occur in Ephesians 5 in reference to husbands and wives. Paul tells children to obey parents. He tells slaves to obey masters or bosses. He does not tell wives to obey husbands. And there's a reason. And this is a key to understanding what submission in marriage is all about. Parents have a right to tell their kids what to do. I brought you into this world, I can take you out. they're not on the same level. Bosses, modern slave masters, my kids might say parents, modern slave masters, bosses have a right to tell their employees what to do. They can fire them. And so you don't have this relationship that you have in a family. Husbands do not have a right to tell their wives what to do. Now, that may surprise you. Depending on what Christian community you grew up in, where you became a Christian, I mean that, and I think that's exactly what Paul is saying here. It all comes down to the meaning of the Greek word kephale, or head. Wives are to submit to their husbands as to the Lord. Now, Paul then says that the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church. Now, some scholars have gotten in the habit of looking at head not as authority, but merely as source. Like you would say, the headwaters of a river, the source of a river. Certainly does have, that's one part of it. But when you look in the New Testament, the word for head, Wayne Grudem did a study I think like 2,500 occurrences of this word. And he said, not one time does it mean source as opposed to authority. It's just not represented in the New Testament. So head means authority. There's just no getting around it. Now, Paul in another passage says that the head of Christ is God, the head of the man is Christ, the head of the woman is the man. So if we want to look at a model for authority in marriage, then we can look at the way that God the Father and God the Son interrelate. How do God the Father and God the Son interact? If you look at John 15, John 16, John 17, Jesus is talking a lot about my father and me, how they functioned together, how they carried out his plan to rescue people. And what's interesting there is you have love, you have acceptance, you have respect, you have mutual service between God the Father and God the Son. But you definitely have authority. Jesus in the garden, he's saying, Lord, let this cup pass from me. However, not as I will, but as thou wilt. But never do you see God forcing his will on Jesus. And never do you see, you know, obviously, okay, so Jesus is sinless, we're not. But the relationship between the Father and the Son is a wonderful model. This is the model for the way the husbands and wives ought to interrelate. Headship has nothing to do with value. It has nothing to do with gifts. It has everything to do with roles. This has nothing to do with who works inside or outside the home, who changes diapers, who cooks, who cleans up, who takes out the trash. Those are all duties of marriage that get worked out peacefully when the head of the family is also a servant. So what I want to show you is a headship of liberation as opposed to a headship of oppression. There's a disturbing number of Christian men who seem to think that being the head of their, you know, being the head in their home means arbitrarily showing their wives who's the boss. Some flippantly decide whether or not they're going to help out around the house just so that they can show that they're in charge. Like, you know, she needs to know who's boss. Some refuse to allow their wives to speak in public lest they embarrass them. You know, you all are married. Glad you're not married to one of these. Some refuse to allow other men to give instruction to their wives because it threatens their headship. These are all examples of a headship of oppression, a headship of control, and it is completely and diametrically opposed to the headship the Bible's talking about. John Stott points out that the biblical concept of authority spells not tyranny, but responsibility. He doesn't go from the head to the one who's ruled over. He goes back to the head, and he puts the onus and the responsibility on the head. Now, submission is, as Brian Chappell puts it, the pouring of oneself into the completion of another. Submission honors and glorifies the other. If you're a woman who's been married more than a few months, you likely have figured out that you have tremendous power over your husband. That's the irony, because in the Bible, you need to talk about the weaker vessel. Smart women understand that they have a tremendous power over their husband. You can rule over your husband by teasing him, by shaming him, by belittling him, by manipulating him. You can do that. But you know, if you do that, you're either going to goad him into retaliation or you're going to destroy him through shame. And a lot of women do that. There's a lot of abusive marriages that is basically a back and forth between manipulation, shame, belittling, and abuse. Back and forth, back and forth. Submission means that you bear with your husband's weaknesses. And nobody knows your husband's weaknesses as well as you do. You bear with them. You help him to grow in them. And you encourage his strengths by affirming him through the gospel. Now, how does the gospel affirm? It affirms unconditionally. It doesn't make demands. It offers freely. And that's what affirmation in marriage has to look like. As you affirm your husband's manhood, you know what you're going to find? He grows in his manhood, and he grows in his leadership, and he becomes more and more the man that you encourage him to be. All right, the third thing I want to look at here is covenant marriage's foundation, loving leadership. And this is going to be focused more on the men. And men, you may have noticed that in the section about women's submission, that I actually talked more about the responsibilities of men than I did about women's submission. The reason is that in this passage, Paul spends twice as much time with men. He spends exactly double the number of verses talking about men. The two commands that he gives, the only two commands he gives in the passage are directed to men. They're not directed to women. We have leadership. We have authority. But that authority comes with responsibility. John Stott points out that Paul never tells men to exercise their authority. I think that is fascinating, and it's so insightful. He does not tell the one with authority to exercise it. Why? Because he's going to do it anyway. He says, What I want you to know is how to avoid from abusing your authority, how to avoid from misusing your authority. Now, Paul was writing at a patriarchal society. In the Roman Empire, a girl was completely under her father's control until she married. After she married, she was completely under her husband's control. She basically moved from one domination to another. She was quite literally a slave, had virtually no legal rights. The status of women in the Roman Empire was described with a root word that came into the English language later as the word imbecile. That just gives you a sense of the value that was placed on women. So into that cultural milieu, Paul cuts this radical swath with his instructions to Christian husbands. He says, love your wives. Now we look at that and we say, oh, okay, no big deal. Of course I'm supposed to love my wife. But our culture is so radically different. We do see romance as a part of the marriage relationship. It's normal for us in 21st century America. In Paul's day, it was not. Most Greco-Roman men used their women to produce children. They didn't actually spend time with their wives. They didn't enjoy them. There was no romance. There was no love. They would get their enjoyment somewhere else. With their guy friends, they would get it with other women. So it was completely a usury, the marriage relationship. And so Paul, in calling husbands to love their wives, to be exclusively faithful to them, and to build them up, he emphasizes all of the biblical principles that were most at odds with his culture. It's amazing. He's not trying to build connections. He blows up that culture and he says, this is what marriage is. So he told the husbands in verse 25, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Now, obviously, there's some things that Christ does for his bride that we can't do for our wives. Okay, Christ makes his bride holy. I can't do that for my wife. Might like to do that sometimes, but I can't. And you can't do that for yours. However, make no mistake that this is not a throwaway command that Paul is giving here. Our wives' holiness is absolutely our concern. Jesus, think about how Jesus offered himself. He gave himself up, literally handed himself over for the church. Now, what does that mean for us? It means that our wives' holiness is in part under our control. Okay, how do we love as Christ loved the church? It means that rather than finding our fulfillment in our own desires, we find fulfillment in pleasing our wives. We give ourselves away for them. Okay, that means when deciding your leisure activities for the weekend, you ask your wife first what she wants to do, what she needs to do, how you can serve her, or better yet, surprise her. Think of something that she would like. That's headship. That's authority. Isn't it amazing how completely opposite it is from the way that many in our culture portray biblical headship? Okay, why did Jesus give himself up? Well, Paul says here that he gave himself up to make his bride holy by cleansing her with the washing of water through the word. So he makes his bride holy through regeneration, rebirth, bringing somebody into the Christian family, and then continually cleansing and sanctification. How does that happen, though? What is the agent of how people are cleansed, are made holy? It's the word. And that's what tells us what our role is as husbands. That's the key. Husbands play a central role in the sanctification of our wives by bringing God's word into our homes. That is our responsibility. And we talked about this at the men's retreat. It may be that your wife has a greater gift for teaching the scriptures or explaining the scriptures to your children. And that is completely fine and wonderful. That's a matter of gifts. God gifts different people differently. However, she needs you to take the lead in talking about what that's going to look like in your home. What shape is that going to take? Delegation, leadership does not exclude delegation, but it still requires somebody to set the tone. And that's what Paul is talking about here. Even delegating needs to be active. The greatest and most common complaint of Christian wives about their husbands is not that they're abusive. It's that they're passive. It's that they're not taking the lead. I remember seeing this so clearly in the movie The Blind Side. If you saw this movie about Michael Orr, who's now an offensive lineman for the Baltimore Ravens, and this was how he grew up. He was basically adopted into this Christian family. He was living on the street. And there are a lot of wonderful Christian values that are portrayed in that movie. Sandra Bullock plays the mom. And this is an evangelical Christian family that's being portrayed in the movie. And it's based on a true story. A lot of great movies, a lot of great values there. But what I noticed about the movie was that the father was just pathetically passive. He did nothing to actually shape the ethos, the atmosphere of that home. He basically did nothing other than watch NASCAR, watch football, crack jokes, and tell his wife how awesome she is. Now, the last part is good. You ought to be telling your wife how awesome she is. But the problem is, Paul is telling men to take leadership. Make sure the word is read in your homes. Pray with your families. And this is something that 100% of us, when we're honest, will say, I struggle with this. I have a hard time with this. I feel vulnerable. I feel ill-equipped. There's all kinds of issues we have. That does not excuse us from making the effort. And I can guarantee you, if you go to your wife and you say, you know what, I'm really struggling with this. Let's talk about this. How are we going to do this? She will help you. But this is a non-negotiable. In verse 27, Paul says, Jesus will present the church to himself as a radiant church, without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Jesus will make his bride perfect and holy, glorifying to the Father. Now, thankfully, that's not our job. We don't have to do that. But our job as husbands is to encourage our wives to radiate God's glory through their inner and their outer beauty. So, you know, one side of that is we need to encourage our wives spiritually. We need to recognize the gifts God's given them, the way that they're growing, and affirm that and get excited about it. But that's the inner beauty. The outer beauty, however, is a part of this too. You need to compliment your wife. You need to build her up. You need to tell her how great she looks. And when she's not looking so great, keep your mouth shut. You have the power. This is where women have, wives have a lot of power over their husbands. Husbands have a lot of power over their wives in a different way than you think. You have the power to allow your wife to get beaten down with the duties of life, of raising children, of working, of running, you know, the house, of doing whatever her role is in the home. You have the power to allow her to get beaten down with that, or to lift her up and to make her radiant. A radiant woman is radiant in large part because of her husband. She looks great because she knows that the man who loves her the most cares that she looks great, tells her she looks great. And if that matters to her, you don't have to worry about who else thinks she looks great because she's not going to notice. She'll only have eyes for you. Verse 28 says, in the same way, husbands ought to, in other words, the same way that Christ makes his bride beautiful, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. After all, no one ever yet hated his own body, but he feeds and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. Now, notice there that Paul does not say he who loves himself loves his wife. He says he who loves his wife loves himself. Those are not interchangeable, the order there. You've got to get it right. You don't have to learn to love yourself in order to love your wife. I remember hearing a sermon by Tim Keller on this, the Blessed Self-Forgetfulness, I think it was the title. And he made a great point that we live in a narcissistic society. In every other age, in every other country, in every other time, people have looked on hubris or pride as a liability, as a vice. But in our society in general, it's actually viewed as a virtue. We talk all the time about how people are struggling with X or Y problem because they don't have enough self-esteem. And Paul says, no, it's not that people don't at times get down on themselves and really suffer serious depression, discouragement. I'm not saying that that's not true. But in general, in society, we already love ourselves plenty. And that's what Paul is saying here. He said, you need to take the love that you already apply to yourself and apply it to your wife. You get up in the morning, you shave, you shower, you groom your beard, you trim your nose hairs, hopefully. You take care of all those things. You care for yourself. He says, care for your wife. Take time with her. The word, it was interesting to me, the word for care for is a Greek word that means literally to warm up. And I think that was meant for New England husbands, you know, in particular. Warm up your wife, especially if she has cold feet. Now, here's the reason we're to do all this. One of the reasons, you know, ultimately we do it for God's glory, we do it for the love of our wives, but it actually benefits us in the long run. Brian Chappell points out, he says, my sanctification, my wholeness before God cannot be complete without glorifying my wife. And that's why Paul says that he who loves his wife loves himself. You love your wife, there's all kinds of backhanded benefits that come with this. You actually grow. Now, unless you're given the gift of celibacy, we talked about this last week, that there you can be single and be complete. This is marriage is not the only estate that is blessed by God. However, if you are not given the gift of celibacy, you cannot be complete without your wife. You just can't. And if you live as if you could be complete without her, you will only regress in your spiritual development. You will not grow. God designed us to grow together. You're called to love your neighbor. Who is your closest neighbor? It's your wife. All right, the last thing I want to look at here is, covenant marriage's reality, a profound mystery. In verse 31, Paul quotes the same verse that we looked at when we were looking at Matthew 19. Jesus quoted Genesis 2:24. A man will leave, you know, a man and a woman will leave their father and mother, be united to their wife, and they will become one flesh. He follows, in verse 32, he follows that last phrase, one flesh, with, this is a profound mystery. And I don't think there's a married soul on earth who's been married more than a few weeks who hasn't, at the end of the day, just collapsed and said, I don't get you. I don't understand you. I don't get this relationship. I can't figure it out. It makes no sense. Men are a mystery to women, and women are a mystery to men. The guy who said we came from different planets was not really that far off. It really is difficult. This is not what Paul's talking about. He says the mega mysterion, the great and the profound mystery, right after the phrase one flesh. Now, his assumption is that his readers are taking him to mean the physical relationship, and there is an element of that that is a mystery. But in verse 32, he takes a page from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Remember, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus over and over would say, well, you've heard, I know you've heard it said, but I say unto you. You've heard it said, but I say unto you. And this is what Paul says here. But I say unto you, I'm talking about Christ and the church. Paul is talking as a pastor to the Ephesians and to us. He says, this is a loose paraphrase. He says, I know you can't figure out this marriage relationship. I know it makes no sense to you. It's a mystery. But don't you understand that this relationship is connected to the great mystery that God makes many people into one? What did Paul say in his letters? There is no Jew or Gentile. We are one people. There is no male or female. We are one people. There is no slave or free. We are one people. The mystery of two becoming one in marriage is just a picture of this great mystery of many becoming one. The walls of race and gender, ethnicity, all of those fall down because of the power of the gospel. And it's the power of the same gospel that makes two very different people become one in the bonds of marriage. Through all the blood and sweat and tears and dirty diapers and all that wants to rip us apart. The gospel enables a wife against her nature to respect and honor and build up her husband rather than ridiculing and shaming him. And at the same time, on the flip side, the gospel enables a husband against his nature to love, to care for, to reach toward, to initiate and affirm his wife rather than passively neglecting or dominating her. That mystery allows us to wrestle with this mystery and actually to see gospel fruit. I want to close with a story about a man named Robertson McQuilkin. He was the president of Columbia International University a number of years ago, and I don't know the dates of when he was there. But McQuilkin was a very gifted man, very godly man, very respected, and very honored at CIU. Later in his career there, his wife came down with Alzheimer's and began to progress in the disease, needed more and more care as time went on. And he adjusted his schedule, he put his office to within like a mile walk of his house so that he could go back and forth as he needed to come back at lunch to take care of her. But as it got worse and worse, she would actually leave the house at times maybe when he didn't even know she was gone, she went looking for him. And sometimes he would come home and he'd find her feet had blisters all over them and bloody from walking for hours and hours and hours. So he did everything he could to try to figure out what can I do? How can I change my schedule to meet the needs of my wife? And he finally came to the decision one day, rather than placing his wife in the care of somebody else, that he decided that he would give up his position. He would resign as president of CIU to take care of his wife. And McQuilkin had no idea what effect his decision would have on other people. He was deluged with mail and contact from hundreds, thousands of married couples who said, "Your decision has changed our marriage. Your decision has brought us closer together. It has made my husband sensitive to me in a way that he never was before." And McQuilkin was shocked by this because he didn't go out of his way to broadcast it. The reason it got out was just because he was a high-profile person in the Christian community. And he was amazed at the response. What he said was, "It was a mystery to me until a distinguished oncologist who lives constantly with dying people told me, almost all women stand by their men, but very few men stand by their women." Now, I don't know about you, but that's very, very convicting. And yet it's true. How paradoxical that this man, in giving up what so often identifies men, what provides men their identity, his career, actually became a more effective leader of men. Isn't that striking? The beauty of marriage is revealed so much more clearly when we're challenged to do what doesn't come naturally. God's grace saved you. I want to encourage you to live out that grace in dying to yourself and reflect the beauty of the gospel of Jesus Christ, because that's how the world sees it. I think that the struggle and the fallout that comes from marriage can be flipped on the other side. Marriage provides the greatest opportunity for a watching world to see the beauty of Jesus and the beauty of the gospel. Let's ask him for his grace to live that out, to do what does not by ourselves come naturally. Let's pray together.